Cyber Serious Universe, Season 27, Episode 25. Coming up on the show, we've got the return of the Monkey Men, eBay lasers versus UFOs, and a motorcycle trip to the moon. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Liking the sound of your voice, Ben. It sounds like butter.
Smooth?
Very smooth.
We got new microphones?
Yeah, they're great.
No one cares. No one cares.
Well, if you think the sound is just a little bit different, some people might pick up on it. It's just because we're using new mics.
Yeah, the old ones were just picking up too much mic bleed.
Sure, yeah.
And then they're condensers, they're more sensitive. We're in a much smaller room than we used to be years ago.
When we were laughing about Japanese porn names, well then of course that was causing bleed through.
I noticed it the most with the segment of the guy getting raped by a dolphin. That really brought out the deficiencies in our mic setup.
Right, so we had to upgrade that and fix it. Right, it should be fixed out.
So we haven't EQ'd them or anything, so it might sound a little odd. We'll work on the sound when we come back next season, because this is our last episode for season 27. We'll be back on the 12th of July for Plus, and back on the 15th of July for the regular show. This is our usual mid-year break coming up next week. But I'm looking forward to this show because I went back to Terry Lovelace's story.
Oh, yes.
And remember, Terry wrote that brilliant book, Incident at Devil's Den, back in 2018. And we covered it in March of 2018. I think it was season 19, episode 9. Mm-hmm. Brilliant story. Terry was an, what did he do? He drove, he was like a first responder. He drove the ambulance at Whiteman Air Force Base. And he and a buddy went on a camping trip in Arkansas. And what resulted was just this incredible abduction experience and UFO sighting. It was really amazing.
I recall, didn't he wake up with an implant in his leg or something?
Well, it was the implant in his leg that led to the memories resurfacing. Because he started jogging and running in whenever he started in the 1980s or earlier. It wasn't really a thing.
Yep.
And the jogging seemed to, it resulted in this pain. He had this weird numb spot in his knee. And he got scans and they found this metal insert in there and all this other stuff in his leg. And every single doctor who saw about it was like, did you have a shrapnel wound in the military? Like, what happened to you as a kid? Did you get shot with something? And he's like, no, I've never had an injury there. It doesn't make sense. And just questioning that brought back all these childhood memories as well. And you might remember the Monkey Men.
Yes.
That he saw as a kid. Now, I went back to Terry's Amazon page, and for some reason we missed his follow-up book. He's published a follow-up. It came out in 2020. It's called Devil's Den, The Reckoning, where Terry goes back through his experiences and adds even more detail that was left out, like really incredible detail on what occurred to him. For example, on the motorcycle trip where he had 2 hours of missing time.
Yes.
We find out exactly what happened there. More details on the Monkey Men. But what really made this book fantastic, this new one, is after he published the original Devil's Den book, he got over 1,300 emails from people all around the world.
Reporting similar incidents?
Reporting their own experiences.
Yeah.
And they matched up in strange ways with Terry's story, which is why, you know, they contacted him.
Are there elements also where he hasn't published details and they had the same kind of details?
Maybe, but just in general, there's a pattern that you start to see.
Yes.
Especially with how people react after they've had the experience and how it changes their lives. And a few of the people that emailed him were Mysterious Universe listeners as well.
Oh, great.
Who found his book through our show and then shared incredible experiences, which are now in this follow-up book. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you on our final show for the season. What have you got cooked up?
Well, as a sheer coincidence, I'm kind of doing exactly the same thing for the Plus extension, because if you recall back in, I think it was 2019, we discussed that crazy story of Clay Wheeler. Clay Wheeler was the guy that was running a very small airport. He ran a repair shop at this airport. You know, this airport had no control tower. This is how small this place was. And he had some really disturbing experiences that would really compare with the Skinwalker Ranch. There were portals that were opening. There were UFOs. There were little Bigfoots running around.
There were mammoths on the runway.
And that's the thing. The best part about that story was that, yeah, he claimed that one day he looked out his window.
Yeah.
And when he looked towards the end of the runway, he could see what could only be described, he says, as a prehistoric savanna with mammoths chewing on the grass. And he could see that the old grass, like the prehistoric grass, was superimposed over the grass that was there today. And he had just some stunning experiences, but unfortunately he continued to interact with the phenomena and ultimately it consumed him. That was from
Kathleen Marden's
book. Kathleen Marden described that, yes.
Extraterrestrial contact. And we did that, what, in 2019?
Yeah, that's right. But I picked up a copy today of Bleed Through, A True Story of Aliens, Demons, and Pure Evil in Texas. This is by Pat O'Connell, or Patricia O'Connell, but she calls herself Pat in the website experiences.com. Clay Wheeler got in contact with Jim O'Connell, who happens to be Pat's brother. Now, sadly, Jim passed away as well. And in fact, you know, Pat writes that two people have died searching for the truth about what happened in this place, and I'm the only one left to tell their story. And she does. And she goes through this book describing the interactions, the forum communications, the letters, the information that Clay passed through to Jim about his experiences on this airport, things that you just couldn't possibly imagine. We just scratched the surface of the things that happened, but also there's this really strange kicker that could completely blow apart the paranormal element of this story.
Yeah, I remember Kathleen was mostly going off the MUFON report, but
that's right.
Patricia actually went out there and spent time with him, interviewed him. Yep. I think she was working on a TV show about him at one point.
She was doing a lot of work. Yeah, so it wasn't just Jim, it was her as well. They were going out there because Jim had established experiences.com. His website went offline for a little while, but it's back now, especially for this book, even though he's passed away. But what Experiences was doing is this group was trying to not really get to the truth about these experiences for these people, but really to help them cope with their experiences, because something like this can be just so overwhelming that where do you go for help? You know, how do you seek assistance? You mean a psychologist, but a psychologist is going to approach it from the perspective of being a mental illness.
So what you're saying is we're rehashing two stories.
Yeah. No, it's not like that at all. I wouldn't want to do that. This thing
is like the next Top Gun. We're taking an old concept and we're hyping it up for 2022.
No, the stuff that comes out of this is honestly mind-blowing, which is why I'm doing it, I think. And the kicker to this is it just makes me go, once again, when you think you've really decided what's going on in a story, this is where the paranormal steps in and just changes it completely.
I like kickers.
Yep. So that's coming up.
How's your throat going? You were sick on the last show.
Oh, yeah, I've just had this flu. I've had this flu that's just been just lingering, but I'm getting better. So it's
Are we going to stop the recording for every cough?
Yes. I can just cough into these new mics. These new mics are so good that I can be coughing right now and you can't even hear it. They're so good.
No, it's going to be like 2,000 edits.
Probably. Sorry, Nat.
I just won't make any jokes. How about that?
Yeah, it's
a very boring.
Don't make any jokes and I won't cough.
Very serious show. So this is Devil's Den, The Reckoning. Terry Lovelace. And again, this is a truly incredible story, a follow-up to his 2018 book. I want to get to the experience reports that were emailed into him. He's picked out the cream of the crop. I think he includes over 30 cases here. But before I do that, I do want to rehash it. Like, I want to talk about his story again, just to refresh it in your mind, because it's pointless expanding on it
if you don't know what it is.
If you don't remember the details.
Yeah. Also, so, if you're a Plus subscriber, you can just go back and listen to that episode.
Exactly, anyway. Yeah. So Terry and his best friend Toby, they worked together at Whiteman Air Force Base, the emergency room there. They were trained medics, certified EMTs. They were the first responders. So they turned up in the ambulance if there was a plane crash or a car accident or someone had a heart attack or something. They were the guys on the scene. They did this job for 3 years, absolutely loved it. And they were kind of nerdy guys, like they weren't your typical like Air Force jocks, I guess. They were kind of nerdy bookworms, but they loved the job because they did the night shift. They went from, I think it was 11 p.m. at night and worked till 8 in the morning.
What's good about the night shift?
Well, it's quiet.
Oh, okay. Well, you get that.
I mean, there's
sense.
No one around, and it's not most days that there's a plane crash. So a lot of the time, because they're in college as well, they're doing college classes. They could study. They had time to, you know, play cards and study, and they became good friends.
Yeah, it's a good deal.
And they were in the Air Force for the GI Bill. Like, they weren't thinking about the Air Force as a career. Terry wanted to go to law school, and Toby was a math genius. He wanted to get an undergraduate degree in physics and then a PhD in astronomy or cosmology. But everything changed in June of 1977 when Toby had an idea to go camping. And this was the story we told on that episode in 2018. And I think Terry said to him, what do you want to go camping? Like, we're city kids, so we don't know anything about camping. But he had an argument ready to go. Toby said, look, you're really into photography, which Terry was, and you've got this great new camera, but you can't take any photos because photography's banned on the base. And photography was banned on the base because they had nuclear stuff there and, you know, weapons. You can't just go around photographing stuff. So he's like, come out on this camping trip and you can take your new camera and you can get some awesome wildlife shots. So Terry liked that idea. He thought, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that. Now, Toby wanted to go out to this place, Devil's Den, very specifically, because it was on a high plateau. There's no light pollution at all. And it would be perfect for sky watching, basically, because he was into astronomy. That's where he wanted his career to go. He just loved watching the stars. He loved watching the sky.
Where is this? Is it Arkansas?
Yeah, Arkansas. Mm-hmm. Now, it's notable that Devil's Den, he writes, is a 6.5 hour drive from Whiteman Air Force Base. And they were like 20 minutes away from all these other amazing places, which they could have gone to for that same purpose, for great sky watching and for nature photography. But Toby, he said, was fixated, almost obsessed with making this trip for Devil's Den for some reason. And it's a bit weird because remember David Politis did that serial, that book on places with devil in the name, where you have all these missing people cases. And Devil's Den is no different. There's all these missing people cases, or missing person cases, I should say, from this area. But Toby wanted to go there. It's this natural planetarium. The only problem was the plateau that he wanted to visit was completely off limits. It was on federal land. It was restricted access. You know, you're violating federal law if you drive on there. There's no camping. There's nothing like that. No hunting. But they thought, what are they going to do? What's the worst that's going to happen? They're going to kick us out of the park. Ooh. So they thought, it'll be fine. We'll just go jump the fence or something. So as the big day approaches, everything starts to fall apart. Like, they had planned and purchased everything. They had like nice camping lantern, fuel, and an axe he borrowed from his neighbor. He had all the food ready to go. They had this brand new large cooler. He had all this black and white film he's going to take for his brand new camera bag. Like, he had everything ready to go. And when the day of the trip finally arrived, they start driving. And they're about 3 hours into this 6 hour drive. And he suddenly realized, crap, I left my camera bag at home. So he's left his camera just sitting on the kitchen bench at home with all the film and everything. And when they kept on driving, they're like, don't worry, we'll just keep going. We can't turn around now. They finally make it to the camping spot. And he describes, like, they come to this sign that says no admittance, you know, you're breaking federal law, and the gate's barred, like a big chain across it. But when they looked, you could just lift up the post and slide the chain off, and then you could just drive in. Like, there was nothing securing the chain to the actual fence. So they just slipped it off and drove in. When they got to the actual, like, the camping site, and it's this meadow. It's this incredible meadow in the middle of the forest. And it doesn't kind of make sense that it's there. It should be overgrown with trees, but it's just this beautiful meadow. They went for a bit of a hike, but when they got back, they realized they were losing light, and it was a massive scramble to get unpacked and get their tent set up. They managed to set it up by using their headlights for their car. And then they realized they had left the lantern. They had left their fuel behind as well. His axe he had left in the garage. And he actually started to worry at this point, because every time they do their shift, they have to pack all their supplies for the ambulance. They have to make sure everything's stocked and ready to go. It was totally out of character to forget so many things. But look at the key things that he's forgotten. He's forgotten the camera. He's forgotten an axe.
So a weapon to defend himself, a camera to record what's going on.
Yeah, it's this whole thing. Like, is something pulling the strings to make sure this whole thing goes off the way they want?
Well, that's the thing. I understand forgetting one thing. But as you pointed out, they were excited and had gone to all the effort of acquiring these items, and they happened to just leave them behind.
And when they finally set up a fire and get that going, they think to themselves, oh, at least we've got our food. And then they realize Toby's forgotten all the food except for like some packets of crisps, chips, and half the beer, and that's it. So they just had some beer and chips and some bad hot dogs. And on that first night, they ate four burnt hot dogs and split a bag of chips. And that's when they realized the Oz effect had kicked in. There was absolutely no sound in this forest at all. It had completely gone silent. And Toby was trying to say, oh, it's just, this is temporary. They'll start up. Something spooked them. The insects will start up again. And Terry said this is where things got very strange, because Toby was looking to his left at something. And Terry's about to say, hey, you know, what are you looking at? And he said, hey, Terry, were those lights there before? And on the horizon, there's a set of three stars, each about as bright as the North Star. And they're sitting in this tight triangle formation. And they just watched in silence. And he said it was about this time that this inexplicable feeling of calm just came over them. He said, I would experience the same phenomena in 2017 as well. It was this feeling of light sedation. Toby must have been feeling similar, because there was hardly a word spoken between us, he said. This thing finally moved after a few minutes. It rotated once as if on axis and oriented itself with the base of the triangle parallel to the horizon. And their reactions were still muted. Like they were subdued by something. They didn't say a word. Like you can imagine if you're seeing a triangle in the sky.
You'd get out of there.
With your best buddy.
You'd be excited and wanting to get out of there.
Like imagine us sitting out there seeing a triangle. I remember when you saw a triangle over your house. You wouldn't shut up on the phone. You were just yelling constantly
down the phone.
It's very strange. And they watched it slowly start to descend over their campsite. They watched it grow larger and larger as it got closer. And this sedated feeling started to wash over them in waves. And he found himself becoming sleepy when they shouldn't have been sleepy, because remember, they're on the night shift. It should be mid-morning for them at this time of night. Now, this craft finally came to a halt directly over the meadow. It filled the entire field. This thing was huge, like a city block in length, this massive triangle. It was like a giant Walmart hovering above them. And it was brightly illuminated. They said it should have been clearly visible from two counties away. But they said after this event, they could never find any reports of other people saying they'd seen this. It came to a complete stop about 3,000 feet above them, really close to them. And he says, neither one of us felt the slightest bit of fear. He said, remarkably, I felt almost disinterested, kind of apathetic, he said, which again, bizarre. Well, they still said nothing. A few minutes after it stopped, they saw some odd beams of light dance around their campsite. And one purple beam of light comes and blasts into their fire, their campfire. Another beam of light is going into their tent and swirling around.
Does it do anything? Does it like go into the ground or
it's
does just, it?
It's moving. It's like search lasers. And this is, you know, back in the 70s, and they said we'd only seen lasers on television.
Yeah.
It was bizarre.
But even today, you don't have a laser coming down from the sky in different colours. You know, like, it's unusual.
Well, in the middle of this, like, Terry has the idea pop into his head, oh, they're scanning us, which sounds logical. But Toby broke the silence by very loudly standing up and going, all right, show's over. And he picks up his air mattress. He shuffles into the tent, lies on top of it face down, bang, goes to sleep.
Mm.
What?
Yeah.
Insane. And Terry did the same thing. He said, I didn't bother to remove my boots or t-shirt. I was just so sleepy. The last thing I remember was Toby already snoring softly and noting that the sounds of the forest had not returned. Then I was out. Now, Terry wakes up what he feels like is a few hours later. And it's the flashing of lights that wakes him up. Like the tent is lit up like July 4th. And he's super groggy. He actually thinks maybe a ranger's found them and is kicking them out of the park for trespassing. And there's this strange sound too. There's this very low frequency hum that's just continuous and kind of warping in and out.
All around him?
Yeah, he said you can feel it in your chest.
Mm.
Now, the first thing he notices is he looks down and his boots are unlaced. And he remembers just going straight to sleep without taking his boots off. And then he looks inside his boots and his socks are on sideways. Like they're completely misaligned. So he kind of straightens up his socks and laces up his boots again. And there's another flash of light which lights up the tent. And he looks over and he can see Toby. And Toby's on his knees staring out the flap of the tent. And because of the light, he can see tears streaming down his friend's face. And he suddenly thinks, like, what's got Toby so upset? And that's when the feeling of being sedated suddenly vanishes and he's scared shitless.
Yeah, that's when the panic kicks in.
The reality is there. Yeah. The fear kicks in and he struggles to his knees and gets to look at the flap as well. And he's like, what the hell are you looking at? He looks out. The triangle-shaped craft has descended now. It's 30 feet above the meadow. And walking around in the meadow are dozens of children. And he says to Toby, he's like, what are these kids doing out here in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night? And his friend Toby turns to him and says, Terry, man, these aren't little kids. Look at them. They're not human beings. They took us. They hurt us. Don't you remember? And he did remember horrific things, but just flashes of something. Being under the control of these things, horrible things happening under the control of these non-human beings. Suddenly, a thick beam of light shoots out from underneath the bottom of this craft and kind of hits the grass in the field. And all these little grey beings, like 3-foot-tall aliens, and they're all in pairs. It's like they're just milling about. They're not really doing anything. They're just like taking a stroll in the grass, like stretching their legs. They all walk into the beam of light and disappear. The craft slowly lifts up, almost like a hot air balloon, he says, and as it ascends, it starts gaining speed and eventually it's out of sight. And he says, to this day, I cannot walk across an open field. Like that tent they were in was their safety and they needed to get to their car to get out of there. But the idea of running to the car was so terrifying. He still has PTSD when he's out in the open today. But eventually they made a pact, all right, we've got to run for the car. They basically left everything. They took their keys and that's it. Sprinted for the car. And as soon as he started running, that's when he realized he was hurt, like badly hurt. And his friend,
in what way?
Just sore, muscular soreness, headaches, aches everywhere.
Did he have bruises, any physical injuries?
Bruises. You could see? Well, I mean, he doesn't have time to look, but he can just feel it.
Yeah.
And Toby was obviously worse because he could barely move and only just made it to the car. And they got out of there. They, you know, hit the gas and drove out of the park. And on the way back, he said it was really strange because Toby was his best friend. And now there was this feeling between them. It was strange. Terry said, I wanted nothing to do with him. It was really odd. And I don't know where this feeling came from. He said, this is actually a phenomenon that he started to see. This is a pattern in these cases. In some of the emails he's received from readers who are sharing their stories, the same thing happens after the event. No one wants to talk about it. And you might think, well, you know, it's obviously it's terrifying. There's trauma that's occurred. But it seems to be something more than that. People often move away from each other. Friendships dissolve. No one wants to hang out together anymore. And just no one wants to speak about it. If family members have an event like this occur, same thing. No one wants to speak about it. It's never brought up again. Not ever.
Well, they don't want to deal with it.
They don't want to deal with it. But there's something else. There's something more. It's like almost like a hypnotic suggestion. Never talk about this.
Mm.
It's been implanted deep within their psyche. Never talk about this. And, you know, naturally you'd be in the car saying, did you see what I saw? What did you see? What do you remember? You would be trying to figure it out. Even if it was terrifying, you would use each other
to validate your experience.
To validate your experience and for support. But that doesn't happen. They shut each other out. And the only thing they said was that they promised they would never tell anyone about it. Now, they make it back to Whiteman Air Force Base and they're hurting. They're really hurting. They're severely burned. He said, we suffered second-degree burns over every inch of our bodies. We never blistered and our skin never peeled, but we were sick as dogs, he said. Both of us were acutely dehydrated and diagnosed with flash burns to our eyes. And that's the kind of injury a welder gets if they don't wear their goggles.
Yeah.
It's where the retina, like sunburn on the cornea. It's incredibly painful. He says it's like having sandpaper rubbed in your eyes constantly. They're both photophobic, so they basically have to sit in a dark room with sunglasses. It takes a week for their eyes to even barely return to normal. And they're both taken to the Air Force Base Hospital, and the Air Force keeps them separated, make sure that they don't see each other. And as the doctor finished his final examination, his base commander turns up with two guys he didn't recognize in civilian clothing. And the base commander basically tells the doctor to, you know, get out. And he says, Sergeant Lovelace, you're to have no contact with Sergeant Tobias. That means you will not speak with him by phone or in person. You will not attempt to contact him in writing or through a third party. You are to give him nothing and you will not accept anything he may try to give you. If you run into one another anywhere by chance, you are to walk away immediately and without comment. That is an order, Sergeant. If you violate my order, there will be severe consequences. Do you read me? And he's just like, yes, sir, loud and clear. It really was this serious. They weren't even allowed a single word between each other. Why?
Yeah, well, it suggests that they know something happened.
What does the Air Force know? A few months later, Toby is transferred to an airbase in Japan and Terry is assigned to a supply squadron. Now, a quick side note, Terry includes Google Earth aerial photos they found in the middle of this federal land, aerial photos of this meadow. And he was astonished that it was still there, like all these years later. He pulled these up in, I think it was 2020. And I want to send you the photo of the Google Earth images included in the book.
Okay. Because you've sent the coordinates, which I've got here.
Yeah, we'll have the coordinates in the show notes, but this is different. This is from an older one from Google Earth.
Okay.
Is there anything odd about that meadow?
It just seems to be out of place. You've got all of this dense bushland around, and then you've just got this one piece of very, very clear land in the middle of nowhere.
Can you see mowing lines?
Yes, I can. Yeah.
Someone's mowing it.
Long, very, very long mowing lines.
Why is someone going out there in the middle of this federal wildlife preserve that you need a dirt track to get out there and all this fuel to get out there in the middle of nowhere and mowing this meadow?
Could it just be some type of natural effect? I mean, is it?
Look, when
you know what's weird? Actually, I'm looking at the Google Earth image as well. There seems to be lines in that as well. I don't know if they're tracks or what they are.
If you look at the Google Earth, well, the Google Maps image I'll link to in the show notes, it's a more recent image. And you can't see mowing lines. You can see tracks from where a vehicle's come and gone.
Yeah, but that
but on
weird
the one he's included
diagonal
in
lines.
The one he's included in the book, it does kind of look like it's been mowed. Why is it being mowed?
Yeah, and then if I look closer, right, then you look to the right-hand side of the image and you can see it looks like there's circles. It's like someone's gone around in circles on it.
So why is this meadow in the middle of this, again, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of this forest, being maintained?
And then, of course, why was it cut off?
Yeah. What's it
for?
What
are they doing there?
Very, very strange. Anyway, take a look in the show notes and we'll link to those images. But when he's discharged from the hospital, he's sent home for 30 days to try and heal. And he's given a large bottle of pills with instructions to take the pills with every meal until they're gone.
Is he told what the pills are?
All they say is, oh, they'll help you feel better.
Ah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he starts taking them immediately as soon as he gets home. And the first night he's home, there's a knock at the door. When he opens the door, it's a nurse who asks if she can come in. Now, she doesn't have a name tag, which is unusual. He says he knows everyone in the hospital squadron. She's not one of the registered nurses. And she has no insignia or rank. And when he asks her name, she just says, oh, it's Janet. And she's all business. She explains that she's at their home for the daily pill count. And she doesn't even ask him how he's feeling. She doesn't check his vitals or anything.
She's making sure he's taking the pills.
She literally counts the pills. And then she fills out a form, like ticks a box, looks at him, and then leaves. It's very strange. Like, no, oh, you know, how's it go? How are the pills going? How do you feel?
Yeah.
Not even of her concern. No taking of his blood pressure or anything. Just good night. And after a while, after a couple of days, his wife pulled him aside and said, these pills are making you stupid. Because he had stopped reading. Like, he always used to read every night. He was now just watching cartoons like an idiot every day.
Yeah. He's being stupefied by them.
And when she asked him, what did you do today? He could never remember. He could not remember what he had done during the day, no matter how hard he thought about it. And she also said, like, his face just starting to look different as well. He was just being turned into an idiot zombie by these pills. So they decide to secretly, instead of him taking them, he starts flushing the dose before the nurse comes, just because she comes at 6:30 p.m. every night. And he starts to regain his senses. And he actually has to act like a dope when the nurse arrives. He's got to pretend to be a bit spacey so that she doesn't think he's, you know, flushing the pills. And eventually he calls a nurse friend at the hospital, and she kind of covertly comes over to his house because she doesn't want to talk on the phone. She says, Terry, those pills aren't in our formulary. They were shipped here from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. You and Toby got the same medication, and I would tell you what they were if I knew. I have no idea what they are. She also said she had never heard of anyone in the medical squadron named Janet, and she knew no one that matched her physical description. Who was this nurse? Why are they getting medication sent from Wright-Patterson? It's very,
very strange. Very, very strange, yeah.
So he does manage to see Toby one last time, despite the orders not to, before Toby shits off to Japan. And his reasoning is he'll get some closure just by saying to his friend, good luck with everything.
Yeah.
I'll see you later. Even though he has this feeling, I don't want to see this guy. Like, I don't even care about him anymore. Like, he just has this weird feeling. And he ends up going to his house, and Toby's wife is really angry that he's there. And Toby kind of comes around the corner in the hallway, and he says he's shocked by his appearance. Like, Toby's disheveled and unshaven and dirty, and he's barefoot. He can smell beer on his breath, and he just looks out of it. He can tell that his friend's in pain. And he just says, hey, Toby, just wanted to wish you guys well and good luck in Japan. And he never finished the sentence because it was so awkward. And Toby basically stepped up to him, and they locked eyes, and he said, it happened, didn't it, Terry? It actually happened. And he said, yes, it all happened. You're not losing your mind. It actually happened. And he said, but why us, Terry? Why did it happen to us? He's like, man, I don't have a clue. And he basically just had to turn and leave. Like, he felt like crying. It was something off about even bringing it up. It just felt wrong to even talk about it.
But obviously he'd stopped taking the pills as well, because how was he able to recall it?
Well, it wasn't affecting their recall, but it was making them idiot. Maybe he was taking the pills, and that's why he was so messed up.
Mm.
Anyway, when he gets back to his car in the driveway, the OSI security is there, the blue security police car. They've followed him. He's busted. He made contact.
So they're monitoring him all the time.
Yeah, they were obviously watching him. Eventually, he was interrogated, and go back to either that first episode we did, which we'll link to in the show notes, or pick up Terry's first book, because he goes into detail about being interrogated by two men in a room, and it's very clear they know what happened to him. It's very clear. And he gets the sense that they've gone through an interrogation like this many times before. Just based on the questions they ask him, it's clear they know that he was picked up by aliens.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah.
So essentially, he was still discharged with honorable conditions. They didn't end up punishing him in any way. And he became a civilian again in October of 1979, and Terry went off to Japan. Oh, sorry, Toby went off to Japan. Now, in 1982, 3 years later, he tries to reach out to Toby. He calls a phone number that he's got for him. He reaches his father. He gets the impression that Toby might actually be homeless at this point.
Why does he keep trying to contact him, though? There's this weird, like, I don't know, he seems to be having a compulsion to keep contacting him.
Yeah, like I said, they need to talk about it to have closure, but there's still this driving impression in his mind not to talk about it. It's like this internal struggle he has to go through. And it seems as though Terry handled it better than Toby did, because eventually they hear from Toby's now ex-wife, and she explains just how bad it got for him. He became an alcoholic. He ended up losing his property. He couldn't hold a job. He just always lost his employment. He had all these horrible issues, and clearly he's got massive PTSD, and he's dealing with it with alcohol, and it's destroying his life. And all she said was that his behavior was just very odd, but didn't elaborate. So he exchanged letters with Toby's ex-wife for a few years, but then lost contact with her. But that's not the end of the story, because a few years later, Terry eventually became a federal prosecutor, and he was working on a case that involved the FBI, and he became friends with this FBI agent. He said this guy was a smart guy, likable. He was close to retirement, but we got along really well. And, you know, they'd have drinks after work, and they were just pals. They talked about boats. And since this guy was close to retirement, and he didn't appear that busy, this FBI guy, Terry pulled him aside and said, "Hey, Frank, you might be able to find a friend of mine. Can I ask you a favor? It's a guy I used to serve with in the Air Force. Any chance you could track him down?" And this FBI agent, Frank, was quite happy to do this. So he heard back from him 2 weeks later. He got this call from Frank saying, "Meet me at a bar. I've got some information on your friend." And he sat down and he said, "Terry, I've got some bad news for you. Your friend is dead. I'm very sorry."
"From what?"
And he's like, "What do you mean, dead? How the hell can he be dead? He's a young man. He's the same age as me." Because they were just in their kind of mid-20s at this point. And he's like, how did he die? Automobile accident on Interstate 94. He and another driver were both killed. It happened 2 years ago. I'm sorry to give you the bad news." And he said thanks to this guy for tracking down the information, and they changed the subject.
Did he find out if it was drink driving, drug driving?
No, just a collision on the interstate. But then in 2017, when Terry was writing the first book, he searched online for Toby's obituary, and he was shocked by what he found. Toby had been alive until 2007. This was 10 years after this FBI agent told him Toby was dead.
This guy lied to him.
The FBI agent lied. Why? Why would he lie about his friend, who was clearly alive and could have been tracked down? Now, he has a theory. He thinks that somewhere there's a file for them. If anyone goes looking for Toby or Terry's details, there's a file that pops up. And the instructions are not to let them get together under any circumstances.
Why? I mean, that's just absurd.
Well, the reason why probably isn't in the file, but the reason there is a file is because you don't want two abductees confirming their story.
But what could possibly, this is the thing, what could possibly, they couldn't prove anything, right? Apart from this implant, even then, it's very difficult to prove anything. So what damage could it possibly do if two guys get together and then validate their stories with each other?
Well, they become the next Betty and Barney Hill. Their story is known by everyone. It just adds to the pile of...
But they've generated enough ridicule surrounding UFO abduction phenomenon that if you've got two blokes that, you know, describe their experiences, they're going to be ridiculed. They're going to have stories made up about them, about being, you know, Brokeback Abduction Mountain kind of thing. That's what they're going to do.
Well, the thing is, if they didn't care and they took that approach, maybe we would have thousands of Terry Lovelace stories.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, okay. So you've got to keep them, yeah, from making larger reports.
Why would you stop it from happening unless, you know, you really needed to put a lid on the information?
Mm.
So this was kind of worrying, and he, you know, just kicked himself that he never actually tried to follow up. He just took this FBI agent's word for it, because he actually could have tracked down Toby and discussed what they experienced all those years ago. Now, This is where he shifts into the Monkey Men. Remember the Monkey Men? He mentions this quite a little bit in the first book, but doesn't go into great detail. He talks about first contact and how he was 7 years old. It was back in 1962. And there was a strange feeling in his bedroom. You know, he's in there in his own bed, but there's a surreal quality to the feeling in the room. Like something's coming. He feels like something's about to happen. And he said from the corner of his eye, he sees a shadow move by his closet door and he jerks his head to the right, but nothing's there. He swears there's motion on the other side of the room, but it's in his peripheral vision. He tries to lie back and clear his mind, but it feels like someone's in the room with him and he can feel eyes on him. Now he rubs both of his eyes hard and when he opens them, out from the shadows steps four little monkeys. Now he asks out loud and says, "What are you?" Now he's awake. These are real monkeys with long tails. They're about 2 feet in height, maybe a few inches more. Their eyes glow yellow. They wore paper masks with broad grins painted on them. He said, "I felt panic and then terror until the one nearest to the head of the bed spoke." And he didn't see its mouth move, obviously, because they're wearing paper masks, but he can hear the voice in his head. And instead of answering the question, the monkey says, "Come with us, Terry. Come with us." And it holds out its paw for him to accept. And the fear leaves his body. He's not afraid anymore. He's just a bit curious. And he said, "I should have screamed, but I didn't. I felt intrigued and we just watched one another. It was like they knew me or maybe I knew them. There's something familiar about the whole experience." And he starts questioning, "Have I gone with them before? Is this the first time I've seen the Monkey Men? It doesn't feel like it."
It just occurred to me, I wonder if he has any insight or perhaps even feels guilt about what happened to his friend, because it seems like in this circumstance that the phenomenon is related to Terry. And then he happens to be in this open field and they have this experience and his friend is there. Was he responsible for his friend being involved in this?
Well, we don't know. I mean, maybe if he had tracked down his friend, we would have learnt that Toby had similar childhood experiences as well.
That's a good point.
And it seemed like it was Toby who really wanted to go out there and he really wanted to go to Devil's Den. But these monkeys keep questioning him in his mind, saying, "Terry, won't you come with us? We'll go and play for a little while and then bring you home. Terry, won't you come with us and play? Your friends will be there too." And the monkeys would take him. Eventually he would go with them. And he would always end up in a white oval room. There would be other kids there his age who he didn't recognize. And there was a woman there he called Sue. Now, he called her Sue because she kind of reminded him of his next-door neighbor. His next-door neighbor was a Japanese woman. And she had some Asiatic look about her. And I think he even called her Sue in these experiences as well. But she wasn't Sue, a Japanese woman. She was Sue, a non-human. She wasn't human. And they'd have to play with these different blocks in this room and form different configurations and do mental tasks. And this woman in the room would speak to them telepathically. And he said you could communicate with the other kids telepathically and there was nothing kind of weird about it. You would eventually learn to tune out their thoughts if one of them was crying or something. It was just all very normal. Well, as normal as it could be. And the strangest memory, he said, was of a girl they called Jenny. Jenny never played with the other kids and he had a feeling it was Sue's helper. She would always carry a jump rope, but they never saw her use it. And he said years later, when his memory was more focused, he realized that, yeah, there was something odd about her. She never spoke, but what she was wearing was weird. She wore this play dress like little girls would wear in the 1940s. It was like this weird caricature of a little girl rather than a real little girl from the 1960s. She had like puffy short sleeves from the 1940s. She always wore white socks and black buckled shoes. She had her hair in pigtails. Again, like a caricature, like a Pippi Longstocking kind of, I don't know. Like,
yeah, they've looked at radio wave transmission from the 1940s because it's taken 20 years to get to them and they've gone, oh, that is how they dress and that's what they've done.
Well, the thing he remembers most about this strange girl was that her eyes were pure white. She had no pupils.
That's That's kind of a reverse from the Greys, isn't it?
Yeah, they were all kind of scared of her because, and she would never play with them. No one ever engaged her and they never heard her speak. And whenever he would actually try and say no to the monkeys, he would scream. Like he would, all of a sudden, whatever effect sedation they would have would wear off and the fear would kick in. He would just scream, scream and scream, wake up the entire house. His dad would burst into the room and he said as soon as his dad cracked that door open to come in, there would be like a whirling energy and all of these monkeys would disappear. Just, they'd just be vanished. And his dad never saw them. So ultimately, he was getting visited by these things 3 to 4 times a week and waking up the entire house. So his family was considerate at first, but you can imagine with the sleep deprivation, everyone's going to hate you after about a week of this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the parents will tolerate it for a certain amount of time, but then they're going to start being irritated by it.
And you can imagine going through this trauma,
feeling lonely,
but then your whole family hates you as well, yeah, and no one believes you. I can't imagine anything worse.
On top of that, you would begin to question your own experiences. As if no one's believing you, especially as a child, you think, am I imagining this?
He doesn't mention that he ever did that because he knew they were real. He saw them, they were physical, they touched him. He knew they were real. He never thought, I'm going crazy or anything. His mother actually tried to help. She was genuinely curious about these monkey men. And she would ask, pull him aside and say, Terry, are these monkeys like the ones on TV or the ones in the zoo? And he'd be like, no, they're monkey men. They walk like men. They want to take me away somewhere. They tell me we're going off somewhere to play. They promise to bring me back in the morning. She's like, Terry, you can just tell them to go away, that you don't want to play with them and they'll never come back. And he's like, I've tried. You think I haven't tried that? They never leave me alone. I scream at them. They never leave me alone. It never works, Mom. And just to kind of de-escalate it, he's like, but all right, I'll try. But he knows he's tried that a million times before. And eventually he says, Mom, the monkey men aren't like animals. They're not like our dog, King. They walk like a boy and are smart enough to talk to me, but they never move their lips. They talk to me from behind their eyes. And she looks at him funny and she says, Terry, they talk behind their eyes. They talk behind their eyes. And he can tell she's just like, okay, yeah, my son's lying. Like, that's ridiculous. What does that even mean? Talk behind their eyes. Like, that's just stupid.
It's telepathy.
And, well, I mean, obviously we hear that and we're like, well, that's what it is. Clearly he's describing it quite well. But she, the concept to her is so stupid.
Yeah, and foreign as well.
She just like, oh, this is ridiculous. We need to put a stop to this. Like, he's just waking everyone up. So the compassion is like out the window when she hears that. The only person that believes him is his buddy at school. And his buddy's like, yeah, we're going to fuck up these monkeys. We're going to find out a way to screw these monkeys. So his friend convinces him to steal his dad's revolver that he knows he hides behind his headboard and it's always loaded. And his friend's, and basically Terry's like, yeah, I'll get my dad's revolver when they'll come in. Blam, 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 blam. I'll kill them all and everyone will believe me. But his friend goes, but what if you miss? He's like, oh, I never thought of that. And his friend goes, well, what we should do is steal your dad's revolver and go and practice really early in the morning. So they have this plan where they have to meet really early, but they have to meet early so that they can practice their shooting, but get home in time for the 9 a.m. cartoons on Saturday morning. Because if kids miss the cartoons at 9 a.m., the parents will be like, what's going on? Where are they?
Yeah, give
so they have
away.
This very elaborate plan. Steal the gun. Go out at like 6 a.m. in the morning in the park, which is just down the road, fire off some practice shots and then quickly run home and hide the gun again and everything will be fine. That's the elaborate plan of these 8-year-olds. So they actually go down to the park that Saturday and his friends like spray painted some targets that look like monkeys. And his friend sets them up in the park. And it's in the middle of the suburbs.
We all know this is not going to go well.
There's like an old lady walking her dog down, like right in clear view of these 2 8-year-olds who have a 32 caliber revolver. And they end up fighting over the gun because Terry thinks there's a safety on it and revolvers don't have safeties, but he doesn't know that. So he's trying to find the safety and his friend yanks the gun out of his hand and then they're fighting over it. They're like trying to pull the gun off each other. And of course, the inevitable happens. Someone pulls the trigger. And they just think the sound of a gun going off is like a cowboy movie in the cartoons. Like it's pew. They just think it's that. But they obviously hear this huge bang.
Yeah.
They smell like gunpowder and they just stop thinking, what the hell just happened? They start checking themselves for blood because, I mean, the odds that they were shot were pretty high in this situation. But amazingly, no one got shot.
Did the old lady get shot?
They just turn and see the old lady running. She's like 70 years old and she's sprinting, pulling her dog along. And they jump on their bikes and start riding home. And
do they take the gun?
Yeah, they take the gun and a police car stops them because obviously someone's called the police because there's a gunshot in the middle of the suburbs. And his friend is really sly with the cops. His friend's like, oh, yeah, we heard this pop and there were some big kids over in the park near the swings. You should probably go check it out. And this idiot cop is like, all right, boys, just make sure you ride home, and drives off, and they get away with it. They just get away with it. It's incredible. So the whole gun thing, off the menu. They managed to hide it. That's not going to work. His friend then says, I've got a better idea. I'm going to steal my dad's bayonet, and when the monkeys show up in your room, you're going to stab them. You'll kill them with the bayonet. So he starts practicing in his room with the bayonet on apples, and his mum keeps finding all these mutilated apples in the garbage. She's like, what are you doing with these apples? He would actually sleep with the bayonet under his pillow, and it gave him like a sense of safety. At least he had a plan for when they showed up. And then finally it happened again. This is about 30 days after he's been training with the bayonet every night and then putting it under his pillow. That sense of dread fills the room and he knows that they're coming.
So 30 days, I mean, is that regular? Seems like they're contacting him a lot or interacting with him a lot.
Well, I mean, there was gaps in between. So it had been 30 days since he had
decided to do something.
Well, since they had shown up and he was just practicing with his bayonet and they hadn't turned up. But again, he sees movement in the room. He knows that they're here. He reaches under his pillow to get ready and he's like, crap, I forgot the bayonet. He had left it in the cupboard because his ritual was to hide it in the cupboard during the day. And when he said goodnight to his mom, he'd sneak out and then hide it under his pillow.
Do you see the recurring theme here, though? He's done this for 30 days. Every single day, 29 days, he's done it. But on the 30th, he forgets the night that he has an interaction, and then going back to the first story when they forgot all the stuff for camping.
Well, it's like maybe they showed up that day because they knew he had forgotten, or they had planned to show up that day anyway and made sure that he'd forget. Either scenario is plausible. And so this time, no monkeys, though. They don't appear as monkeys.
What was it this time?
They appear as the way we know them.
Grace.
As Grace. And he doesn't get taken to a playroom. He doesn't get taken to see Sue with the other kids. He finds himself in another white room and essentially he's strapped to a table. And there's no more Grace. There's giant insect-looking 7-foot-tall creatures that look like praying mantises. And this must be where he gets an implant or something because they do something to his spine. It's incredibly painful. He says, yeah, they're insect-like beings, 7-foot-tall praying mantis-like things with triangular-shaped heads and huge compound eyes. He said, I would meet one of them again 14 years later, which is detailed in his first book. But all he remembers is screaming because when he woke up in the morning, his throat was hoarse from screaming in pain.
And did his parents inquire as to any odd behavior in the night?
Like, no.
Nothing was noticed?
Nope. They just think he's having night terrors and he needs to grow out of it, which is, you know, it makes me angry.
Yeah.
It makes me really angry. It's like they're destroying his life. Now, he includes this story here, which explains from his understanding why they're appearing as monkeys. And I thought this was brilliant. So when he was a felony prosecutor, a police detective came to him seeking an arrest warrant in a child abuse case. And warning, this is a disturbing story. He said the accused was a house dad who babysat his 7-year-old stepdaughter while his mom worked the evenings as a nurse. And he said, look, we sat in the conference room. It was me, the lead detective, the little girl, and her mother. and a social worker from CPS. And he says to the social worker, look, can the little girl tell us what happened? And she spoke up. Everyone listened. Jane, her name was, she complained that while her mum was at work, some nights her stepdad turned into an Indian and then marching music started playing. And she said, we then take off all our clothes. My stepdad's eyeballs, she said, go in and out. And then it's a glamour model game. And she said from her mother's lap, she said, stepdad takes naked dress-up pictures of me. Now, there are some details he omits, but, I mean, no physical injuries. He's not actually doing anything to her. He's taking photos of her. It seems like that's it, fortunately. She swore he never touched her. He just took pictures. So at Terry's suggestion, they had a forensic therapist interview the girl. And Jane's story remained consistent. And the social worker found the facts of the story, though, unbelievable. But the girl was credible. She knew the difference between truth and lies. She knew the difference between right and wrong. But the story was bizarre. His eyeballs go in and out, marching music starts playing, and he transforms into an Indian. Like, what? That's crazy. So they didn't have enough evidence to get a warrant, not yet. And the little girl eventually went to live with an aunt while they, you know, kept investigating. And the little girl's mother 100% backed her husband and resented the police getting involved. Now, 2 weeks later, the little girl's mum is cleaning a guest room in the home. And she looks up at a ceiling tile and she notices that it's just slightly out of place, like not even a quarter of an inch off. And she's like, that's weird. She reaches up and the tile is loose. Now, she gets on a stepladder and she can see that hidden in a cavity in the ceiling, out of her reach, is a shoebox. So she gets a coat hanger and manages to get the shoebox down. And she's devastated by what she finds. She takes it to the detective immediately. And within an hour, he's knocking on Terry's door saying, do you remember the marching Indian with the funny eyeballs case? He's like, yeah, of course I remember. And he hands over the box. Inside the box was a Polaroid camera, a dozen assorted photographs, a computer hard drive, a cassette tape of marching music, and a cheap costume of a Native American war bonnet, and a pair of novelty glasses with eyeballs attached to springs that pop in and out. So the stepdad made the little girl's story sound so outrageous that without the physical evidence, no one would believe her.
About it. Yeah.
No one would believe her.
Yeah.
A jury would rightfully have trouble finding him guilty based on the little girl's story alone. Now, he says because of the hard drive, this was eventually passed on to the FBI. And he says, look, I promise you justice was served in this case. But I thought this was really telling. When you think about ETs showing up as monkeys,
yeah,
with masks on.
Mm-hmm.
He said they knew no one would believe me. It was devious in multiple ways, he said. At first I saw circus monkeys as comical and benign. They chose to appear in a way maybe I'd find less threatening and adults would find impossible to believe. Their hope was to take me voluntarily, if possible, without a grown-up or my sleeping sisters involved. And He has to date more than 1,300 people emailing him, telling him about their stories. And sure enough, he says dozens have told him about visitors who appear in strange ways in their bedrooms in various disguises. So people told him that when they were between 4 or 6 years old, they've seen owls, deer in their room, glowing orbs, raccoons, cats, even Disney characters turn up in their bedrooms in the middle of the night, communicating with them telepathically. Of the 1,300 people who have he's responded to, he finds about 400 of them rock solid and he actually believes their stories. And there's this thread that runs through all of these patterns that emerge. A good percentage of them say that despite all the birthday and holiday parties, the vacations and wonderful playdates on summer breaks that have been lost to time, they can still vividly recall these dreams, that they've had, these interactions with these raccoons that turn up in their bedroom. They always appear solid and sentient. They report that this was not sleep paralysis or any kind of psychological disorder. They assert it happened multiple times and this was reality, not a dream, not a confabulation, not a fantasy. And for Terry, it was always the same four little monkeys. Now, in his mind's eye, he sees them with little red jackets, but I mean, it's when you think about it, that's why I thought it was so good that he included that story of the little girl, because it really does make it clear. They're not showing up to make you feel at ease. It might be a part of it, but there's an extra tactic to showing up as something ridiculous.
Well, particularly when it comes to children, because if you were to appear as looking something relatively normal and a child describes that in their bedroom, a parent is obviously going to be like, well, what the hell? Who's breaking into our house? But if it's like, oh, you've got little monkeys coming out of the cupboard. Oh, you're just having a bad dream, darling. Don't worry about it. You know what I mean? Like, that's what's going to happen. Yeah. And ultimately, the child's going to be dismissed.
Yeah, I mean, you're never going to believe.
No, of course not.
It's just so silly. Eventually, he learns that his cousin Gerald, who he sees maybe twice a year at most, who lives in another state far away, his cousin Gerald opens up to him. They're about the same age. And his cousin says, these little clowns come into my room and they've got yellow eyes and they ask me to come with them.
So there's the familial connection as well.
Yeah. And he shares his story about the monkeys and these two become like brothers. They've got this sick, no one believes them. And he says this, his cousin says he never remembers going with them, but he knows that he has. And also, like Terry's dad, Gerald's dad has a gun hidden in the house and he knows where it is. It's always loaded. This time it's a rifle. And Gerald used that rifle to commit suicide in his teens. So in a way, Terry's really lucky that he managed to maneuver his way through this trauma.
Yeah, this stuff is so destructive. It's all-consuming. It destroys people's lives. I mean, it's abundantly clear when we talk about Clay Wheeler's experience. It's like this stuff really, particularly though, it's not just paranormal phenomena. It seems to be the extraterrestrial phenomena that causes this.
So one story that I remember we did mention in the 2018 episode was his motorcycle ride. This was in 1987, and he does this usual Sunday motorcycle ride. He goes for a couple of hours, then he makes sure he's back at home to make pancakes for the kids and his wife.
Mm-hmm. I don't recall this, so remind me.
Yeah, so he does this motorcycle ride, and he's back by 9 every time, but this time he finds himself riding on the tarmac, and then all of a sudden he's on a dirt road in the middle of a cornfield, and he's like, what the hell? How did I get here? It's no recollection of any transition. He's like on the road, normal route, middle of nowhere, cornfield, dirt road.
Like he's teleported.
Yeah, like he's just there all of a sudden. And he's just like, what the hell? Maybe I'd zoned out. He turns around and rides back down the dirt road and eventually hits the blacktop and remembers where he is and drives home. He gets home. His wife is furious because he's like 2 hours late. He's missing 2 hours of time. Now, he never knew what had happened on that motorcycle trip. But eventually he got answers. So he got answers in 2017. This is October. He and his wife had just returned from a movie. It was late and, he'd locked up the house and he goes to bed. He remembers falling asleep almost immediately. And I think this story was in the last show, but I can't remember how much detail he gave. But he wakes up in his armchair downstairs. And he's like, I never sleepwalk. I don't know how I got there. Like I was just, no, my wife didn't hear me get up. I was just in my armchair. Didn't make any sense to me. Why was I in my armchair? And he's like, he opens up his eyes. And sitting across from him in the living room is a 4 foot tall woman. He at first thinks is an Asian lady.
Does he think it's Sue?
There's this weird Asian lady sitting in his living room. And she's wearing oversized sunglasses and a really cheap wig.
It's Yoko Ono.
And he can tell she's not a human. Like, it's a really, we know how the greys to dress up with their wigs. At first glance, like, you would walk past her on the street and think, okay, the circus is in town, but something's
is
off.
Is her lipstick smeared?
Yeah, like, her complexion is ashen. It's a bit blue as well. Her proportions are all wrong. She's dressed in black. She's wearing a black blouse buttoned to the top. She's got this weird scarf that's obviously to hide her pencil-thin neck. And she's wearing sturdy black shoes, but it's got a huge heel because she's obviously only 4 feet tall because she's a weird hybrid or something. And this weird wig from the 1960s, and it's kind of askew because her head is so big. And before she's finished the thought, God, I wish she'd remove those glasses so I could clearly see her face. As if on cue, she takes her glasses off. And that's when he recognizes the face immediately. And it's, you're right, it's Sue. It was this woman, alien, that was in that room he was taken to when he was a kid. That was the room the monkeys would take him to.
What does she want?
Well, as soon as he recognizes that they're in that room, they're talking telepathically, he's like, oh shit. What if I think of something really provocative right now and she hears me think it? And he's like, don't think about sex. Don't think about sex. Don't think about sex. And then all of a sudden, the most elaborate graphic porn scenes start playing through his mind, like horribly inappropriate things. And you know, we know Greys have no emotion, like they're just virtually robots.
Yeah.
But even she's like, ugh. Like she kind of, she gets a bit, ooh, that's a bit much. So, this is a point he makes later. It's like he claims that the reason human beings can't speak telepathically is because we cannot control our thoughts. Because we grow up so used to our thoughts being our own and they're contained, locked away in our own psyches, we never have a need to really control our thoughts, to hide them from people. But he says the reality of interacting with these beings is that everything you think is like you're just speaking it out loud.
Yeah.
Every single thought. And just think about that for a moment. Just think about how many people you would offend walking down the street.
Oh, everyone. That'd be it.
With your hate thoughts. Just constantly. You wouldn't be able to interact with anyone. And you would be constantly doing what he's doing. You'd be like, don't think about it. Like, don't, it's like that when someone's got a really big mole on their face. Like, don't look at the mole. Don't look at the mole. You can't even do that. You can't even think, don't look at the mole, because then they can read that thought and know that you're thinking about their mole. There's nothing you can, like, you have to have, think about the absolute control you have to have over your psyche. And he's like, they have it, but human beings don't. And it's almost like, you know, when you've got a dog, you're obviously the superior intellect and you're looking down at this dumb sentient creature that trusts you and loves you. He says, that's kind of what it's like with these entities, but you're the dog.
No, but we don't trust them.
And they don't love you.
Yeah.
there's no love there. So he then accidentally thinks, her wigs kind of reminds me of Betty from the Flintstones. And he then gets the feeling that she's offended by this thought. That he Why? Thinks her wig. And she actually asks him telepathically, oh, do you want me to change it? This is the same one I wore last time. And then he thinks, hang on, the same as last time. When last time? And she says, the last time we saw one another. And he feels concerned that he's insulted her about her wig. A few seconds later, her answer came. She shows him a scenario that he saw play out in his head. He was a passive observer. And it's basically the motorcycle thing. He sees himself parked on the side of the road in that cornfield on the dirt road where he had the 2 hours missing time back in 1987. And what was left out of his memories was that there was a flying saucer parked in the cornfield.
Oh.
And this kind of stairs come out of it and he just willfully walks aboard. And there's like a row of seats in this beautiful white seats. And for some reason, there's some front row seats and there's a bunch of farmers, like human farmers sitting in the seats, not saying anything. But he goes and sits down and Sue, who he now calls Betty because of her wig, she's sitting there. And he's like, oh, hi, good to see you. I haven't seen you in a while. And he sits down, straps himself in. And she basically, you know, says, nice to see you in her telepathic greeting. The door to the UFO closes and they feel this gentle kind of lifting. And he gets taken to a mothership, and this mothership is orbiting the moon. Now, I've got a vague memory of him describing some of this at the very end of the first book, but he left out a lot of detail, which is included here, which is mostly questions that she answered for him when he was aboard this craft. So long story short, they basically dock in what he thinks is some kind of warehouse, but it's essentially a giant ship that's near the moon. And she takes him along this, you know, corridor, and he can see out the window, and he says the stars, you know, don't twinkle like they do on Earth, and you can just see billions and billions of them. It's incredible. But he describes looking out and seeing the moon heading towards them, and he freaks out. He thinks they're about to hit the moon, and she says, oh, don't worry, we're orbiting the moon. It just looks like it's coming towards us. And he looks down, and he can see buildings. There's like skyscrapers and... like it looks like office buildings sporadically placed around the moon. He can see the lights all lit up. He can see other craft silently landing down on various ports on this moon base. It's like a moon city.
Is he sure it's our moon?
Oh, it's definitely our moon. It's like looks exactly the same as our moon. And he can see the line where the dark side of the moon starts, and it's all kind of behind the line. You know, he just describes seeing all these buildings, and essentially it's like they're standing in front of this observation window, and there's an exchange between them. And when he notices that there looks like apartment buildings there, like with windows, just like you would see on Earth, he says it actually looks like LAX when you're looking down at it.
Why would they have windows on the moon when there's no atmosphere?
Well, so you can look outside. Why else would you have windows?
But you can't open them. You can't do anything about
it. Can you open windows on the 103rd floor of a building?
No. I don't know. I'm just thinking the idea of there being, but really, I mean, apart from seeing stars, if you're on the dark side of the moon, what are you looking at?
The moon. What do you mean? What are you looking at?
Well, you're on the dark side. There's no lights.
Well, you're looking at all the other lights. You're looking at all the stuff out there. You'd be able to see the stars and everything. What do you mean? Of course they're going to have windows. You think aliens don't have windows?
I'm surprised that there's buildings there. That's all. I'm trying to get my head around that.
Yeah, well, if that's your only problem with it, that they have windows. But because he sees what essentially looks like apartment blocks, he asks her, hang on, are human beings living here on the moon? Because it just looks like our buildings. She says, yes, my people, hybrids, and my hosts, the aliens, also reside here with humans on the surface. There are others that reside inside the moon below its surface. And Betty described the moon's subterranean inhabitants as reptilian and said they are possessive and territorial like humans. Now, he asks if they're still there. She replies yes, and she emphatically states the moon is a hollow artificial vessel. She said it's been in our sky since long before man appeared. And she explained that the builders left a clue for mankind to discover. And that, of course, is the fact that the solar eclipse of the moon fits exactly over the face of the sun, completely covering it in the sky. Like this ridiculous mathematical anomaly we have clearly in front of us. She says it defies statistical probability, and your ancient ones recognize this. Now, according to Betty, it is not an organic space object. She said it was manufactured a long time ago. Its original inhabitants abandoned it before the rise of mankind, and the reptilian entities discovered it vacant long before man had evolved. She further stated that these reptilian entities live in your western desert and have since before man evolved into intelligent beings. She matter-of-factly said reptilians feed on blood from cattle and will feed on human blood and tissue as well. Now, this he definitely left out of that first book. He was like, I don't want to overwhelm you with all the truth bombs. He said, your government has a treaty that limits the number of human beings and the number of cattle that the reptilians can take. She said the reptilians have no obligation to return them or agreement as to their ethical treatment. She said since the mid-60s, they have failed to honor the agreed limits. And he's like, what are you talking about? What limitations? She says, well, the limits on the number of humans they may lawfully harvest.
Harvest?
Harvest. She says, likewise, the number of cattle from private ranches and federal land is limited according to the conditions in the Eisenhower Accord. So there's always been this conspiracy that Eisenhower made a deal with the Greys.
Yeah, to give up a certain number of human beings to abductions every year so that they don't
overwhelm us. It was with the reptilians. The Greys have been getting a bad rap this whole time.
Don't the Greys work with the reptilians? Isn't that what we hear in many abduction cases?
Well, the Greys are just robots.
Yeah.
He discovers later he's convinced that they're just...
For the reptilians.
They're just robots for anyone. It's like you hire them out.
Oh.
It's like you can... If you had enough space credits, you could have...
Alien Uber.
You could have your own Grey army.
Why?
Just, I don't know. I could think of a few things I'd do with a Grey army on Earth. I could think of a few things. He says... she says... The public face of your nation's space program is from the Apollo missions. Like he asks her about the Apollo missions and the shuttle missions to the moon and everything. And she says, human beings have lived on your moon for many generations now. Your government has two space programs, one for the people and another that is secret.
So, yeah, what shuttle missions to the moon is she talking about? Because we've never sent shuttles to the moon.
That's my mistake.
Oh, okay. Oh, sorry.
Apollo missions and subsequent shuttle program is what he's asking about.
Yeah.
She says, just like your nation, countries have governments with superficial control, but there is only one global council that truly represents and controls your planet. Many people begin work for the covert government as young people and will serve in that capacity for their entire lives. And he's like, why do these people and alien beings even live on the moon? What's the point? What's here? And she says, they're here to collect the rocks. And he's like, what? And she says, helium-3 is the gas inside the moon rocks. That's all she says. That's the only explanation she gives. They're there for helium-3. Now, he said that I failed to grasp the enormity of her statements at the time. She had just confirmed, number one, the existence of a secret space program. Michael Sala, vindicated. Number two, that extraterrestrials and human beings live on and inside the moon. Number three, that extraterrestrials reside inside the Earth and some have free reign to abduct cattle and humans by a written agreement. And number four, she inferred the existence of a global ruling council. And he's like, these were four concepts that I just thought were wacky, crazy fiction. And yet here I am, on a quick Sunday morning motorcycle ride, now standing over a moon base, having these concepts explained to me by an alien that looks like an Asian lady wearing a bad wig.
But we have to ask the question, Ben, and it's really simple. Why? Why are they taking abductees and revealing all these secrets to them? Why? What purpose would it serve?
Well, he seems to think he's being prepared and trained for something in all those... childhood encounters, that organizing the blocks in that room and being taught to communicate telepathically were all for preparing him for something. And this is a pattern, again, we hear from these ETs. And a lot of this stuff had happened a long time ago, though. Although this encounter, he says, is from 2017. No, he's meeting her in his living room at 2017, but the motorcycle thing was 1987. So sometimes I think maybe they had all these plans, if any of this is true. They had all these plans, and then for some reason...
It didn't
pan out. And they had all these, these Manchurian candidate, like warriors ready to do something. But in the end, they didn't need them. I don't know. It's a good question. What is all this for?
Yeah, why go to this? It feels like you're putting yourself at risk of being discovered, for one. I mean, I know it's an isolated location, but if you're landing a saucer, you are putting yourself at risk. Then you're basically coming up with this hideous plan, and then you're taking your enemy on board and going, here's our whole plan. Like, why? It doesn't make sense.
And then again, if any of this is true, why should we assume that he's being told the truth?
Yeah, right? I don't think it's the truth at all.
Why should we assume that any of this is accurate information? And it's not just, again, it's not an equivalent of them turning up as monkeys. It's some kind of illusion.
It's exactly.
Some kind of ruse.
It's theater.
She says, some in the secret space program serve on your moon for life, but most serve on Earth. Terrestrial government leaders rotate and show a face to the people of national pride that keeps the population satisfied. They feel secure and believe they are competently ruled and protected. They believe the illusion that they have some control over who rules them. But there is a consolidated global leadership among the collection of governments with regional and territorial interests at odds with one another. Your world is a single global entity and it has a single ruling council. That's some big conspiracy bombs dropped by our alien friends on the moon.
It's not doing so well at the moment, I can tell you that.
So there's much more in this. There's much more explanations being given by this wig-wearing alien grey hybrid. But what I wanted to talk about was some of these case stories that have been sent to him that really have parallels with his experience. I'll just mention a couple before we go into our Plus extension, because I know we're getting close to that time. The number one here is The Christmas Store by Olivia Henderson from Nevada. She's a 76-year-old widow, originally from Reno, Nevada. And this experience was on a weekend trip from Las Vegas to Reno back in 1968 with her husband. And he was a doctor and had to work late at the doctor's office, even though they planned on doing this road trip. So they didn't leave until after 6 p.m. And they had everything booked, so they still drove and they went along the highway. They stopped at their usual diner and had dinner, and then they hit the road again. And they were going to arrive at the hotel at, like, I don't know, after midnight. But they keep driving, and then after they've just had their dinner at the diner, they see this Christmas store. And she's like, we've never seen a Christmas store. In fact, because it was the 1960s, they'd never seen a Christmas store ever. Like, Christmas stores didn't really exist back then. And to have a Christmas store on the side of the highway, and it looked brand new, like brand spanking new, amazing lights, like a inflatable Santa out the front and Rudolph and all these beautiful lights spinning around, like this beautiful Christmas store. And she's like, honey, let's stop and check out this Christmas store. This is amazing. And so they start
to, shiny because it's a lure.
They start to pull over and they realize there's no car park. It's just desert. It's just like sand next to the Christmas store. And so they don't end up staying. They just kind of slow down, pull over to the curb and stare at this crazy Christmas store. And then she remembers her husband just kind of pulled away and they kept driving on their trip. And they're just like, that was such a beautiful Christmas store. Anyway, on the way back, they spend their weekend at their destination, and on their way back, they think, she says to her husband, well, let's stop at that Christmas store and just have a look. Like, obviously they haven't opened yet because they haven't built a car park, but let's just see if we can check it out. And of course they're driving back. No Christmas store. There never was a Christmas store. And they stop in at the local diner and they say to the lady, like, who opened that new Christmas store? And she's like, what are you talking about? What Christmas store? And eventually, this is a really long story. Eventually they speak to the mayor of the town because he, like, officiates any new businesses that open there, and he confirms to them, no, in fact, there is no new businesses at all, especially no one running a Christmas store in March. So what was the Christmas store? Well, I think you've guessed correctly, Aaron, that was some kind of lure, because nightmares followed after this Christmas store, and they never wanted to talk about it.
What kind of nightmares?
Well, all she says was she has these dreams where she's pulling into the Christmas store, and then something horrifying is happening, but she can't see what it is because she feels like she's wearing goggles that are covered in oil.
Oh, weird.
So it's just she can't see anything in the dream. And then her husband has nightmares about the Christmas store as well. But it's the same thing where they never want to talk about it. They just never want to bring it up. But they know each other has the dreams, the regular dreams about the Christmas store.
You know what they both need? They need individual regressions.
Well, that's what he says to a lot of these people. Like, you need to figure out what these memories are. And then there's a case from Garrett from Midland, Texas. And when he was in his mid-20s, he had a life-changing event. He was a firefighter in Midland. He retired in 2016, but when he was 27, a bunch of the guys at the firehouse, they all bought rifles and they planned on doing a hunt for wild hogs. It's kind of like, you know, let's get away, let's have a team building exercise, drink some beers and roast a couple of hogs that we shoot and we'll have a great time. So one of their guys, his name was Jeff, his family owned a hunting camp with 50 acres that was full of hogs and they were pests. So, and they had a trailer out there. So they had this great weekend trip lined up and they ended up, you know, taking their guns and going out there. And one of the guys was an older guy. He was in his 50s and he was having some trouble with his health. And on that first night, he retired early. Like, everyone was having a couple of drinks and no one was super drunk, but he was like, guys, you know, I'm not feeling great. I'm going to go lie down in the trailer. So he went and laid down. And at this point, they had only shot one pig on this first night and it was on the roast. It's on the spit. And about, I don't know, 50 yards away is the tree line on this property. And Jeff looks over and he's like, what are those lights in the trees? And they all look over. There's two of them out there now. No, actually, there's three of them out there now. And Garrett, who sent in this story, is like, yeah, what are those lights in the trees? And he thinks they must be poachers. So they let off a few warning shots and the lights don't move. And they get this funny feeling like that something's wrong, right? And Garrett, who sent in this story, tells the other guy that's there, just go in and check on Melvin, you know, the older guy that's gone to bed. Just go and check on him because, you know, we want to make sure he's okay. He just gets this feeling to go in and check on Melvin. So this other guy goes to check on Melvin and then immediately comes out of the trailer and says, Melvin's gone. And when I was reading the story, I thought, well, he's dead. He's died of a heart attack. No, he's physically vanished. He's gone. And at this point, Jeff, whose property it is, he continues firing warning shots and walking towards the light in the tree line. And Garrett's like, what are you doing, man? We've got to find Melvin. Melvin's gone missing. And it's like he's not listening to him. It's like he's in a trance walking towards these lights. And so Jeff thinks, okay, this guy Melvin, he can't have gone far. He must be taking a piss in the outhouse or something. So he walks over to this outhouse and he grabs the handle. He's like, Melvin, are you in there? He grabs the handle. And the next thing he knows, he's sitting in the trailer, dazed, confused. Melvin's lying on the bed inside the trailer with a sheet on him. Jeff's kind of storming up and down the trailer looking confused. And they're all inside the trailer and they don't quite know how they've gotten there. All of a sudden, they're just there. And Melvin kind of wakes up and said, oh, how was the pig? So they all go outside and it's now the sun's coming up and the pig is just ruined because it's just been completely burnt. And Jeff just says, all right, it's time to go. Any complaints? And they're all like, no, let's go. They're meant to stay three nights. They all end up driving home. Not a word is said between the three of them. No one discusses what happened. No one questions why they all of a sudden got teleported into the trailer. No one questions what those lights were in the woods. No one asks what the hell happened to Melvin. Where did he go? No one says a thing. And Garrett said the last thing he remembered was seeing Jeff walking off towards the lights and seeing three hooded figures coming towards him. And that's the only kind of memory he can pull out of it, these three hooded figures coming out of the forest.
You have to wonder if that's some weird archetype, though, that sits inside your brain to shield you from the true vision of what these things are. Like, is it something that you're generating or is it... like,
what's the archetype?
Well, like, why are they wearing hoods? Like, why are they hooded figures that are coming through?
Well, heaps of abductees have described hooded entities.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if someone's having such a horrifying experience, like these beings are so terrifying that the mind somehow clouds them. But then again, yeah, maybe they are actually just wearing hoods coming through, but it's just, I don't know, there's a very icky feeling about this stuff. No matter how many times we talk about abductions, I just can't get my head around them.
Well, when they get back to the firehouse, there was one guy who had an excuse. He said, oh, you know, I don't really feel well. I'm not going to go on the trip. And when they're all back on Monday, he's like, how was the hunting trip, guys? And they're like, don't talk about the hunting trip. Like, they're all pissed. They're all pissed at him for even bringing it up. No one talked about that hunting
trip. Like this misplaced anger.
But because they all slept at the firehouse, because, you know, they had night shifts and everything, this guy Garrett said every now and then one of them would wake up screaming.
That's not normal.
And every single one of them knew they were screaming about a nightmare from the hunting trip.
Why? Why did they know it was from the hunting trip?
Because they all had nightmares about the hunting trip.
Right.
But they never spoke about it. Now, there's a kind of an epilogue to this story. He said after he retired, he tracked down one of the guys that went on this trip and he ran a restaurant now in one of these, you know, smokehouse restaurants in Texas somewhere. And he tracked down his friend and he said to the waitress, you know, tell the chef there's an old friend here. And his friend came out and they shook hands and he asked him, he said, do you remember what happened at that night? And all his friend said was, no, but I'm still having the nightmares. And they didn't want to talk. That's all they wanted to say about it. They didn't want to talk about it anymore. Like, no one wants to talk about it. It's the same with Terry and Toby. no one wants to talk about it. No one even wants to be friends anymore after the event. Why? Now, coming up after the break in the Plus extension, I want to mention a case from Elliot in Massachusetts. I'll just read you a little bit at the start here. He says, "My name is Elliot. I'm currently in a Boston suburb, retired from the restaurant industry. I recently heard about your book on the podcast Mysterious Universe. There are a couple of points in the story that definitely got my attention, so I bought your audiobook to check it out for myself." And there's actually a couple of Mysterious Universe listeners who sent in their experiences to Terry, and we'll feature some of those in our Plus extension coming up right after the break. If you want to get access to that, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. Aaron's got a huge segment coming up with our friend with his airport and getting spewed on by UFOs and
peed on. Yeah. He literally gets peed on by a UFO. But it's worse than you could possibly imagine.
Where does it come out of?
Well, we don't know that. We just know that it has some eggshell-style skin, and then gross. He gets peed on by gross. A UFO. But it actually has, beyond being gross, it has some very terrifying complications. And we're going to go into how his life was torn apart, including his interactions with the Oreo Man and all these things that had odd beings that had appeared at his airport and had turned his life upside down.
It is a great story.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah.
MysteriousUniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. Get the big extensions on these shows every single week. Plus members also get exclusive shows that come out on Tuesday, of course. And if you're a Emmy Max member, you get access to our back catalogue, so you can go back and listen to Season 19, Episode 9, where we first mentioned the Lovelace case. And access to our entire back catalogue when you're on MU Max. The book again is Devil's Den, The Reckoning by Terry Lovelace. Make sure you check it out. And of course, much more coming up. For Plus members after the break, sign up today. $9 a month. Help support your favourite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you not next week, but the week after. See you then.